We started with Jerome talking about the really the in a philosophical sense the planning and the aspiration that that we had 5 or 6 years ago, and then one thing he didn't mention, which was quite convenient, was that the ODA was given its own planning powers by the government. I recommend it to anyone. And one of the challenges, in fact, for us was not to actually abuse that, and in fact to work with the local boroughs, to work with the community, and in fact to, in a sense, follow absolutely the normal planning processes, albeit with, in a sense, the hammer behind our back, that in fact, if the push came to shove, we could always insist on what we wanted. But I think, Jerome, we've never actually had to do that, and we've got through all the planning process in a normal way with the boroughs putting all the pressures that they would normally have expected to put upon us. Simon then took us through this sort of much more hard-edged construction process, one which, and I sat next to a lady last night at a dinner who said to me, well, I was always opposed to the Olympics because I was convinced that we wouldn't be able to build it on time and it would all be a disaster. Well, in fact, as you will have gathered from what Simon has told you, that has been the opposite from the reality. The reality has been that we're now 93-94% complete. We're nearly £1 billion below the budget, which was established at the beginning. And the British construction industry has undoubtedly done an excellent job and has created the platform which Andrew Mawson has just been talking about for the future. And Andrew, of course, has brought us slap bang back to the reality of people. The YouTube is fascinating because until the YouTube was created and developed by Jerome together with one or two enthusiasts in the local community and getting some pressure put on the boroughs, there'd been all sorts of discussions about having a visitor centre at Olympic board level, with the usual wrangles going on about who was going to pay for it, where was it going to go, which borough was going to have it, and frankly it was going nowhere. And actually what was then created was a very good example of what Andrew has just been talking about, where in fact very often the sort of local enthusiasms and just getting on with something which is far less grand than was probably being talked about as a visitor centre, but has been immensely successful, has never been vandalised in any way whatsoever, although it's in a totally open public space, and literally coach loads of people come from all over the country and use it every day to witness the development of the park. So it's a little microcosm, which is another example of the sort of thing which Andrew has just been talking about, and which in a sense creates the challenge going forward, so that in the future this 600 acres, the size of Hyde Park piece of land, the people who live around it and the people who live in it will see it as theirs, and the rest of us in London will see it as being somewhere that we want to go to, whether it's to work, to enjoy leisure, or to indeed, of course, engage in sport. But it has simply become a moulded and integrate part of London, and that is the challenge going forward. So engineering the Olympics is undoubtedly a complex issue, which is a lot more than just simple engineering. And for those of us who are engineers, it's been an education, I'm sure, in many different respects. But now it's your opportunity to engage with one another or with us. We don't mind either. But certainly we've got an hour, probably, if necessary, but whatever time it's required before people run out of questions or comments they might like to make. But it's now your opportunity to pick up the baton from us. And let's have some questions, let's have some discussion, or any points that you would like to make.
I'm Andrew Powell, and I'm chairman of Easter. So first I'd like to say thank you all to all of you for a very interesting evening. But I'd like to ask a little something of a side issue. You mentioned everything to do with the park itself, but nothing as to how people are going to get there, which it strikes me as being a fairly critical activity. So Can you explain a little bit about how the transport is going to work?
Okay, it's a very good question, actually, and not just an important one for the Games, but actually importantly for the creation of this new piece of city, actually, in the East End of London. The site was based on the location of the international station developed for the CTRL, for the Channel Tunnel Rail Link at Stratford International. So it sits immediately adjacent to that. And that's one of the reasons, actually, why it was chosen, that there was an opportunity here being created, not just by the station's presence, but by the land that was being created around the station. But it also sat adjacent to Stratford Regional Station, which until, I think, probably about 2006, people hadn't really recognised the real opportunities that sat with that. It's, if you look at the connections that can be made from Stratford Regional Station, underground and overground, and the DLR that links into it, it's actually the second best connected station, we think, in London after King's Cross in terms of the distance you can get and the connections that can be made. So again, one of the key features of our investment in the land was ensuring that that station was capable of being brought up, not just to meet the standards required and the capacities required for delivering the huge numbers of spectators into the site, but also that it would then continue to reward the area, if you like, from having that capacity in terms of the development capacity that might be realised around it and from it. And I think probably the first example of where that's being realised is the development of the Stratford City Shopping Centre, which opened only a few weeks ago. I think the owners predicted something like 500,000 people visiting it a week, and since its opening it's achieved something at least double, probably more than that, a week, and over 1 million people visiting that shopping centre a week. And that would only be possible through the investment that's been put into the rail services and the public transport systems that connect to that area. So the ODA had invested about £1 billion in upgrading a lot of the systems, and that ranged from extension or signalling upgrades for the Jubilee line, extra carriages on the Jubilee line, upgrading the North London line, and a whole variety of other systems. One of the biggest achievements, though, I think, has been the use and the adaption of the CTRL line to provide what will be operating during the Games and known as the Olympic Javelin Service, which connects Stratford to central London, to King's Cross, in 7 minutes. If you think that in people's minds, historically, Stratford was seen as a suburb, which took around 40 minutes by tube to reach from central London, the transformational impact in people's minds as to where this place exists within the context of central London and London has just been astronomical. And already, I think, we're seeing in the way in which investors are looking at the area, this recognition that it's no longer considered a piece of outer London. It's now considered very much a connected piece of central London.
Philip Baker, I'm the immediate past president of the Association for Project Safety. A question for Andrew. Andrew, I think a really interesting presentation because it connects engineering to people, which is very important. More than 20 years ago, I was involved with blowing up the first tower block in the country, just to the north of the site there. And my worry is about the gentrification of the area, the cost of housing rising and local people being forced out. What's being done to stop that?
Yeah. Well, the historic problem of the area was there weren't enough business and other people living there. I mean, the problem in Bromley by Bow was it was all dependent on the state, and 97% of all the housing in poor condition was the state. What we need is mixture. What we did about it is we created over the last 14 years a housing company called Poplar Harker, which now has nearly 9,000 properties. And what we did was when we began to take over an area of land on just on the opposite side of the road, really, from here, and develop it, we got really purposeful with residents and we got real about all of that. So today we're involved in an area of land the same size as the Olympic Park on the opposite side of the road. The housing company owns 34% of the land, and what that's allowed us to do is begin to develop different forms of home ownership, really. So there are real choices for people, because actually, if you're really going to get hold of life in East London, you do need to get wealthier. You do need to get a decent home. And we need to encourage people to come and live there who have skills. The street in St. Paul's Way, precisely what we're doing, is trying to mix a whole generation of young people with business people, scientists, the chemists across the road. So you aspire to go like that. And we want to make sure on that street we have a school capable, 200 of the 500 homes will be for sale. Now, we'll only get that right if the school is good enough education for you to want to put your children there. If the health facility is going to be good enough to want to use. That's the real test on health and education. That's the challenge to us all. And that's just one street. So there's more work to do, but we're very clear in East London, and I think key people like Sir Robin Wales, the Mayor of Newham and others are very clear, is we have to move on from some of the 1970s thinking of the public sector, and we have to make a place, and also in the five villages in the park, that work for people from many different backgrounds and also work as an economy, because they have to be sustainable. What we don't want are more housing estates in East London. This will be a disaster for OPLC if we end up leaving, after all of this, five housing estates. Yeah. That would be a disaster. So it's that tricky stuff about how do you make that work in the real world when the silos of government still coming down on us are still living a bit back in the 1970s, if I'm frank. So it's how do you really make this stuff work? And that's the challenge of us, for those of us who've been working there for quite a time, and it's the challenge of the Olympic Park Company. Yeah.
The Olympic Village, which we've built, consists of 2,800 apartments, which range from roughly 1,000 one-bed, 1,000 two-bed, 1,000 three- and four-bed. Simon mentioned that, in fact, we'd now disposed of it, having built it with public money. We've disposed of it in two parts, and the first part went to a housing association, for what in London terms is called Affordable Homes. Affordable Homes covers everything from subsidised rent through to partial ownership. And the other 50% we've sold to a private sector developer who in the initial years is likely to in fact let out most of the apartments that he owns, because you wouldn't suddenly put 1,400 apartments onto the market to sell. So the initial, and then there will each, the plan is there are 11, basically 11 blocks within the village, and the plan is that each has its own management committee made up of people, obviously, with shared ownership, rental ownership, subsidised rental, and so on, all of whom will be living within that particular block, again, trying to get some, obviously, a mixture of different backgrounds and different ownership types within each of those 11 blocks. But clearly, the challenge in the longer term is that very issue of management, the degree to which it's controlled and managed by the people who live there, the degree to which the maintenance is done properly and held up, because if you start to let the fabric go, then you'll start to see the behaviours go with it. So the village is one of the biggest challenges, and the first phase of housing to be added within the park is in fact going to be low-rise housing, which will go on the area where the basketball stadium is, which is adjacent to the village. So housing, a very key part. We've built 3,000 so far, and then the legacy company's plans, we're probably talking about another 6,000 units over the next 10, 15, 20 years, This place is just going to be a place of continuous growth, continuous development, whether it's in housing, further schools, or commercial property, and so on. So, but no, it's a good question. Just coming back to add a point on transport, we see these as public transport games, and there is no parking at the Olympic Park for you and I to turn up in our car unless we are a blue badge disabled driver, in which case there are parking arrangements, but otherwise it's very much either by train or by bus, long distance or park and ride. And in fact, we expect probably at least 75% of the people to come, as Jerome has said, by train, because of the sheer number of options that one has to get to Stratford by train. But the athletes themselves we have to deal with separately. And some of you will have read about the Olympic Route Network, which causes a bit of a stir. And these are essentially a dedicated route which is assigned to the athletes, but it's not closed off to the public. So, in fact, the roads are open to the public, but it's also, in some instances, got a lane which is allocated to the vehicles which are carrying the athletes, the officials, and the Olympic family. who have to be guaranteed their journey times to get from A to B on occasion. So that's how we deal with the Olympic family and the athletes.
Andrew Morley, I commend very much the achievement of ODA, but looking at another legacy, I wonder how well the engineering construction industry will sell its achievement in delivering the Games infrastructure to deliver infrastructure in the country at large, which is so, so desperately needed to give growth. We hear over these days of the dilemmas in the Eurozone and the effect on growth, but we desperately need infrastructure, work on our infrastructure. Do you feel that ODA and the engineering institutions will sell to the broad public the benefits of infrastructure?
It's a good question, and it's one which we are asked quite often in terms of what have we learnt about this process. Now, apart from my slightly off-the-wall remark about planning process, which would clearly help our infrastructure a great deal going forward, but one of the things which has been key to us has been cross-party political support. And I make the observation regularly that, in fact, if you can actually get cross-party support, then life becomes a lot easier. And I think this is the first challenge that we have to get to grips with in major infrastructure in this country. Sometimes, at the moment, you could almost argue it seems to happen by accident. For example, at the moment, we have everybody opposed to a third runway at Heathrow. But I would personally argue that is because it's politically convenient to wave the environmental flag around that particular issue. What it doesn't do is address the other aspects of the argument in terms of the economy, the demand for travel, and so on. So we're sort of looking at it in isolation as an environmental issue. It's got to be looked at in a much wider approach, and we don't have a clear airport strategy in this country at the moment. We don't have a clear energy strategy in this country at the moment. And one of the other aspects which we've seen here is the criticality of a deadline. And in fact, many people at the moment would talk about the deadline around energy. The fact that by 2022, we will probably not have enough energy to actually deliver the energy requirements that the country has unless we start building not just wind farms in the North Sea, but actually further nuclear and further nuclear quickly. And so deadlines become important, political consensus becomes important, and of course the sort of planning and thinking which Jerome has been talking about. Now, a lot I see in London, and I see through various organisations, the Institution of Civil Engineers produces its infrastructure forecast every year, which does get read, does get listened to. I think we are making some progress, but I think probably everybody in this room who has a voice and has some involvement in engineering organisations, we just have to keep banging the drum about the fact that the infrastructure needs are long-term needs. In the short term, they can actually be the solution to many of the economic problems that we face, and other countries are talking about that as well. It can be financed with private money. It doesn't have to be financed by public money. When there's a shortage of public money. But these are 30-year, 50-year decisions, and they can only be made in an intellectual way, in the way that the French made intellectual decisions about nuclear power 30, 40 years ago. They made intellectual decisions about high-speed rail. As the French at the time said, you don't consult the frogs when you're draining the swamp. Consultation has become a much used and abused word, but you have to do it. But you have to do it with an objective in mind and recognizing that you can't please everybody and that there have to be compromises. And I think sometimes we forget what we're trying to achieve because we get so bogged down with debating and arguing, consulting, and actually not coming to a conclusion. And certainly, I regard part of my role today and my role going forward is to continue to bang that drum that you've just mentioned, and I'm sure I would rely on the support of many people in this room to help in doing that. But that is, I think, a responsibility we all hold, and we need to use the, in a sense, the The confidence that I think we've been able to build in many politicians through the activity of the engineering construction industry here on the Olympic Park, that we can do things, we can do them well, we can do them on time, and we can do them in budget. And therefore, if there are things which we can see need to be done, then you know it can be done and it can be done well, so let's get on and do it. Andrew.
Can I just make a comment about it? Because I agree with what John is saying, but I agree from a different perspective. What the interesting thing, this is about the clue in the micro. On St. Paul's Way that I mentioned, the residents 5 years ago voted to become part of a housing company that would build these new 500 homes. 4 years later, 54 schemes later, £3 million of public money, not a flat had been built, actually. These people were living in damp accommodation with rats, etc., etc. Every man and his dog had an opinion about this who were not living there. And the people who were paying the price were some of the poorest people in this country, actually. And you get the business plan there with 35% social housing. And suddenly Mr. Livingston would come along and say, no, we want 50% social housing. The business plan collapses. Then some other environmentalists, etc. If you trail through the effects of one street of this reality on people's lives, it required me to try and get one or two people to stand at the top of the old school to say, look, I need you as the head of the Homes and Communities Agency to get hold of this problem and take responsibility and drive it through, which is what they did. But actually, if that had not happened, that component just outside the Olympic Park would still be going on today and people would not be getting flats. So I think there's very good social reasons, because often people say, well, it's all about the people, there's all these terrible people. But actually, I tell you, ordinary people in East London are sometimes paying a massive price for this indecision. And in some ways, you know, nowadays, politicians talk easily about building 50,000 homes or whatever. Having built a few homes in my life with organisations, I sometimes think it's a miracle that anything gets built, because we're also busy discussing and having opinions about it. So I rather agree with John, and I agree with it, because actually it really matters for some of our poorest communities as well, actually, as well as big projects like that.
John, can I just
add? Yes, Simon.
The other thing that we've done, launched recently, is the ODA Learning Legacy. So in order to try to provide a voice and to provide an archive of a lot of what's gone on, we've created a website which is linked to our London 2012 website, which has 250-odd papers, articles, investigative reports and useful information from the Games written by many of the participants in the Games. So it was written by contractors, consultants, some by other organisations like the Health and Safety Executive, some by universities who've looked at what we've done, said whether it's good, bad or indifferent, and captured those lessons and provided them on a publicly available website for future projects and organisations to learn from. This has been heavily supported in government, so we have the ear of the Major Projects Authority, the MPA, who've now taken over from OGC, and others who really are supporting this drive to use the good practice that's been developed or been enhanced or been successfully adopted on the Games, and to drive that through into the public procurement and public sector infrastructure projects of the future. So that site is up there and running now, so we hope it will provide a little bit of added momentum.
John, yes, Stuart Hawkins, I have the pleasure of working on the Olympic Park at the moment. With reference to the main stadium, which has been variously described as too small to host the opening ceremony, too big to compete with the other 80,000-seater stadium in London, and the wrong shape to play football in, how do you think the venue itself deals with the first hurdle of legacy, as it were? How do you think that has come together?
I've never heard it described as too small for the opening ceremony. It's not too small for the opening ceremony. It will work very well for the opening ceremony. But you're right. I mean, there is this constant, you know, there has been a lot of press debate, etc., about the future of the venue, and we've had the recent saga with the football club's involvement. But I think what we've discovered through the process of design of the venue is just how flexible it is and how extraordinary it is as a concept, in that we set out originally talking to one or two football clubs. There wasn't the interest when we went into the construction process and the design process at that time that we could gain a sufficient commitment to a, a long term at that point. So we felt we very much had to build as much flexibility into the form of that building as possible from the outset. And as Simon alluded to, the original concept was to construct it for 80,000 that it needed to be for the opening ceremony, and then enable it to be dismantled, or a large extent of it to be dismantled, to reduce it to 25,000 seat, which was considered to be the appropriate scale for an athletics venue, multi-use, in legacy at that point in time. The process that we've gone through, and this is also, I think, an interesting point about how you do regeneration and how you change people's minds about a place, has been extraordinary, really, in that we started the design process back in 2006 without a confirmed legacy user and no one on the market really saying they wanted this building. We're now in a position where we have football clubs arguing with each other to try and gain the rights to that building, and that's largely because it's being built and they've seen just what an amazing facility it can be, and it's developed the imagination around what it could be in the future. The process that we went through as the football club interest rose in looking at the way in which it might be adapted to meet both the athletics and the football demands, and the football demands are a slightly less capacity than the 80,000 that we've built, and forced us really to look at the way in which you might take it apart and piece it back together again to meet those changing demands. And that process was really revealing in the way in which that venue can be adapted in so many different ways. In fact, the design process that I was involved with, we looked at capacities ranging from 25,000, 31,000, 45,000, 60,000, and 80,000. All of them can be achieved through the reconfiguration of the upper bowl, the 55,000 seats that sit in the other bowl, the upper bowl. It's quite extraordinary. In my view, it's a revolutionary design in the way in which you deal with major venues of this kind, where you don't have that future outcome in mind. The other component of that thinking is also looking to the long-term future. And, I showed you the picture of the White City Stadium, which is now a shopping centre. We don't know in 100 years whether this stadium is indeed going to be there at all and whether it's going to be replaced by something else. So the other process that we went through as part of the design was to look at the foundations, to look at the way in which the decontamination was undertaken, and the way in which we laid out the bowl to ensure that should dramatic change happen to that venue in the long term, it could also, that piece of land could also cope with it, and the utilities providing the services to it, etc., could also cope with those kind of changes. So actually what you've got is a very, very valuable piece of real estate. You've got a very, very flexible building that can be adapted for immediate use and for longer term use. And I have no doubt that wherever we end up in terms of the final use of the venue, particularly the mix of athletics and football, that it will be a success and that the building can cope with that.
I'm Rob Glue. I'm from St Albans School. I was just wondering about the facilities that are in the stadium at the moment, because I've heard that there are actually very limited facilities in the stadium building itself, and whether that's actually going to be viable for 80,000 people moving in and out of that stadium.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that is unique about the venue, and if any of you are football fans, you'll know that when you visit your local stadium, it's full of cafes and shops. Well, some of the bigger ones, isn't it? Arsenal is, anyway. I'm a Tottenham fan, and it hasn't got anything like the same facilities, but it will do soon, I hope, in Tottenham, we hope.
Shopping's done differently in Tottenham.
Certainly be more successful anyway, but and on the pitch, at the moment, it's a very valid point. With the way in which it had to be designed actually to enable it to be as flexible as I've just described was to take a lot of what you normally find inside the building out of the building and put it on the edge. And the concept, which is a difficult one to grasp in people's minds, I think, is that the venue is not just the building that you see, it's the island on which it sits, it's the land on which it sits. And if you start to think of it that way, you can see how by placing the merchandising, the cafes, etc., on the land immediately around the main structure, that you can reduced the scale of the building itself because you don't have as much space to provide within it, which reduces the amount of steel you need to put into the venue. But it also means that you can start to change pieces of that venue quite quickly and quite in a variety of different ways. It also means that when you have a multi-use venue, if it's doing athletics one week, which might have 25,000 people, and doing football the next week, and it might have 40 to 60,000 people attending, you can also then operate it in a very efficient manner because you only need to provide the support facilities to meet that capacity for that weekend's demands, if you like. So, you know, half the number of cafes will be needed for a 25,000-seat athletics meet than would be needed for a 60,000-seat football meet. So it becomes a much cheaper operational facility for the future operators and owners of that building at the same time. So by taking all of that stuff out, I don't think we've reduced the offer of what the stadium brings. And we know from distances from seats to toilets, seats to cafes, etc., it still works just as effectively as most stadiums that you will have been used to going to visit with all the venue, those kind of facilities within. But it also allows that flexibility and actually I think will facilitate much easier, more easily that multi-use purpose.